All right, ready?
Okay. I'll ask the clerk to announce the case and the parties. I mean, the lawyers.
The court will now call Christie New Grove versus the state. The mayor please the court. Mr. Chris Hayes, on for the account. And Ms. Jael Blumlein, the other for the state.
Okay, counsel, you ready to proceed?
Come forward. May it please the court. Counsel. Your Honors, this case, I represent Christie Newbrow, who was indicted and charged with fraudulently possessing a controlled substance, specifically hydrocodone, and ended up landing her 5 years in Texas Department of Criminal Justice. It all started out when she went to a pharmacy located within a grocery store in the city of Carrollton in Denton County. She tried to pass a prescription for hydrocodone. The pharmacist was suspect of the prescription because of several things that are noted in the record. He then tells her to come back later on. He'll fill it in a little while. She leaves, comes back. In the meantime, Carrollton Police Department's there and waiting to take her into custody. And when she's taken into custody, she makes statements stating that she did not know that this prescription was forged. It was made out to a different person. She gives a story to the police officers that this was given to me by someone who lives at the extended stay hotel where I'm at. She lives maybe an apartment or two down. She was too sick to come to the store. Asked me as a favor to come bring it and fill this prescription. And she's taken into custody, subsequently indicted, goes to trial. At that trial, this witness, who she said, she gave this name of this person who gave her the prescription and said, you know, if you please go check out this person, they will tell you that they gave me this prescription, that the prescription is in their name, and I didn't know it was forged. Carrollton Police Department did not follow up on that. At trial, her defense counsel did. They subpoenaed that person, who ended up making statements prior to trial to one of the attorneys that was involved on this case. Those statements were recorded by that attorney. She does seem to back up appellant's story there.
Well, she seems to.
Yes, ma'am.
But particularly, for it to be admissible, it has to be a statement against interest to overcome the hearsay objection.
Yes, Your Honor.
What statement in that recording, because we have the benefit of the recording, what statement was made that was actually against Brooke's interest?
She's
very slippery.
Yes, ma'am. She is very equivocal on that tape.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there are parts of that tape that are good for appellant and parts that are bad.
Mm-hmm.
But in that
in
tape,
the best light for you, what statement was made that was actually against Brooke's interest?
She basically helped.
Now, I agree there were some statements that helped the appellant, but what statements were against Brooke's interest?
Well, she would absolutely be guilty under a law of parties theory based on those statements of, I gave this prescription to the defendant. The prescription originated with me. If my client is guilty of this,
didn't she say I may have given some prescription to her. It might have been this one.
Right.
Isn't that really what she said?
She says maybe, but then later on in the tape says that she did give this to her. And certainly they should have been allowed to cross-examine her on that matter. Unfortunately, she invokes her fifth.
Right.
And so,
the question becomes, could someone else testify as to what she told them, because it's a statement against interest and an exception to hearsay? And so what I'm trying to get at is, what statement against interest did she make?
The fact that she gave that statement to her, it corroborates everything that appellant had said and is a statement against her interest, because it also implicates her in this potential offense, which would be possessing or attempting to possess a controlled substance.
So you think that in that tape recorded statement, she actually says, I gave her that hydrocodone prescription?
Yes, ma'am. She says she gave him those prescriptions. And that there's a hydrocodone prescription. Excuse me. That's a big word for me. A hydrocodone prescription. There are also some other prescriptions that are found on appellant as
well. And she doesn't use the word may have?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean,
okay.
Perhaps my memory's clouded on that, but I believe it's in there. I know she equivocates. The tape is several minutes in duration, and so she flip-flops from time to time, but I'm pretty sure that that's in there, and that was why they wanted those statements to come in so bad at trial, appellant's trial counsel did. And I believe that they were statements against penal interest, because I think it 100% implicates her in this commission. I also think it implicates her, and it's telling that the state did not want to grant her immunity in that case, because I have a feeling had she gotten up there and said those same things, she might have ended up indicted too. hence the need for her Fifth Amendment protections and why she invokes the Fifth Amendment. So I believe 100% it implicates her in this and is a statement against penal interest. Therefore, at trial, I believe that either her trial counsel, one of her trial counsels, Mr. Floyd, ought to have been able to testify to that, or, in the alternative, he was ineffective for proceeding as trial counsel when he knew prior to trial she was probably going to take the Fifth. That's exactly what happened here. She invokes prior to trial happening. She's appointed counsel about 4 days before trial. There's no reason, there's nothing in the record at least, as to why that was done or why the court knew that that would be necessary. Nothing that I saw, but at least 4 days prior to trial, counsel's appointed to her to advise her of her Fifth. She then takes the Fifth before voir dire and trial on the merits commences. At that point in time, it's pretty obvious everybody knows she's not going to testify about these questions that appellant wants to ask her at trial. Despite that knowledge, no motion for continuance is made. There really would not have needed to have been a motion to withdraw at that time. But Mr. Floyd continued on as trial advocate here, and by doing such, attempted to ride one horse with two saddles, basically, and that's to be trial counsel and witness at the same time, which is prohibited by the Rules of Professional Conduct 308.
Doesn't it all hinge on whether or not that statement would be admissible?
Yes, Your Honor, if that statement
was admissible. Because if it was admissible, then he should have known it. He should have withdrawn as the attorney so that he could be the fact witness. But if it was not admissible, if it wasn't a statement against penal interest, then there was no harm done because he couldn't have testified to it.
Yes, ma'am, and that would be right to the second prong of Strickland, that if there's no harm here, then there's no ineffective at all.
Right.
And so I believe that it was a statement against penal interest, that it does it certainly does show that Ms. Brooks had knowledge of these things. It corroborates 100% appellant's statements and goes to her also constitutional right to present a defense under the 14th Amendment. And I believe that that should take priority here and allow her to have that due process right. But by going forward in that position as trial advocate, put him in a precarious position, put her in a negative light with the jury. And what's telling here is that the jury, I mean, if you check the record, at one point in time, there's an exchange that might have occurred out in the hallway between a juror and somebody. It ended up being nothing. But that juror is questioned later on by trial court. And the trial judge asks him about that interaction. It ended up being a non-issue. But he does inquire, are these the only witnesses we're going to hear from? The jury, I think, wanted to hear from Brooks. They didn't get to see her invoke the Fifth. They didn't get to know about the fact that she was subpoenaed. The only person available prior to trial when she invoked the Fifth going forward who could have potentially gotten that statement in was Mr. Floyd, and by proceeding as trial advocate, he was thereby prohibited under 308 from being both witness and trial advocate.
But that could have also been trial strategy, because he could have decided, I'm not going to be able to get that statement in anyway if she takes the Fifth. And that could have been part of his strategy, is that he believed it wasn't admissible. We don't know.
That's possible. I just don't see how a trial attorney would think that's good strategy, Your Honor. And I think that's why it deviates from the standard of norm here, especially when we've got the standard written in black and white in 308 of the Code of Professional Conduct.
But it is a murky question as to whether or not it's even admissible, is it not? I mean, it's not black and white whether that statement is really admissible, because she does him and haw around in that in the recorded statement, right?
She does. She equivocates throughout the entire statement, Your Honor. But we'll never even get to know, but for the fact that we continued on as trial advocate and put ourselves in a position we knew we were going to be witness. And what's telling is he wasn't even court appointed or listed as attorney of record in this case. He didn't need to withdraw. There was no motion that was even necessary. It could have been as simple as him just waiting in the hall and not proceeding as trial advocate at that point in time and letting lead counsel, Ms. Jimenez, who was court appointed in this case, taking the reins, going through trial, calling him as a witness. At least at that point in time, appellant would have been granted her right to try to present her defense, try to get those statements in, since we knew prior to trial that that witness was not going to testify. And because of that, I believe she was deprived of both her 14th Amendment right to present a defense and her 6th Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel. Those statements never came in. It seems like the jury was expecting something like that. It went to the heart of her defense, which was that I was ignorant of the fact that these prescriptions were fraudulent. They were simply given to me by somebody with a request that I fill them. So that being the case and those things never coming in and that part of her evidence not coming in, we believe she was denied a fair trial. For those reasons, the other ones listed.
Mr. Abel?
Yes, Your Honor.
What evidence is in the record as to whether or not the other prescriptions, not the hydrocodone prescription, but the ones that were admitted that she talked about after she was arrested, were fraudulent? Was there any evidence in the record that those also were fraudulent prescriptions?
I don't believe they were really investigated, Your Honor. I'd have to double-check the record to see if they were fraudulent.
I didn't see anything in what I looked at that said that there was evidence presented that those prescriptions were on 8x11 paper and were signed by a doctor, supposedly verified at the doctor's office that it wasn't his signature. Any of the evidence like that? I didn't see that.
I don't recall that, and it would be odd for someone to fake a prescription for pink eye medication. I wouldn't.
Well, the evidence is admitted for the purpose of showing that she had submitted the prescription for hydrocodone, but not the other prescriptions that might have been more directly related to pink eye. And I'm just wondering if those pink eye prescriptions were in fact given to prescription lady by a doctor and were valid prescriptions.
And I'm not sure, Your Honor. I didn't see anything in the record that really spoke to that. At least I don't recall that.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. If there's no other questions on the remaining points of the brief, then I'll yield whatever time I have extra or yield the floor, I guess, to the state at this point in time.
All right. Well, thank you. We will then call the state, Mrs. Sabalon?
Spoolery.
You ready?
Yes. May it please the court, counsel? As far as your question regarding whether the other prescriptions were fraudulent, I took a closer look at the record, and the presumption by the state was that they were valid. During closing argument, one of the prosecutors argued to the jury, and we have another valid prescription for antibiotics that she did not fill. So the state was working on the assumption, under the assumption that the other prescription was legitimate.
The state was conceding that whether there's proof of those things or not, that the state conceded that those were valid prescriptions.
I don't think any investigation was done into whether or not they were valid, but I think for the state's argument that it indicated that she knew or should have known the hydrocodone prescription was fraudulent, the state proceeded under the assumption that the other prescriptions were valid.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for answering that.
Sure. As far as the ineffective claim and whether the statements were against Mrs. Brooks' penal interest, since we touched on that, I want to develop that a little bit further. The Court of Criminal Appeals, in trying to decipher whether statements against penal interest are considered inadmissible hearsay, has put up a two-prong test, which includes, first, the question is, does that statement subject that declarant, Miss Brooks in this case, to criminal liability, and did the declarant realize that at the time? I think listening to the recording in State's Exhibit 6 carefully, she's very, very, very strongly asserts that she does not want to say anything that will subject her to liability. She even says, I'll testify for you on the condition that it doesn't get me into trouble. She's very, very strong in her assertion that she is not saying anything that could harm her in any way. So I think on the first prong of that
test, she says she doesn't intend to, but that doesn't mean that down the road she might not say something against her interest. Just
sure.
Because she didn't intend to at the front end. The real question is, did she say something that was against her penal interest?
I don't think she did. I think she said things that indicate any interest, any information regarding appellant, which is clearly not against Mrs. Brooks' penal interest. She says, she does equivocate. She says, I thought they were valid. Then she talks about some discussion of obtaining prescriptions online that I'm not totally sure I followed what she's talking about. She kind of goes back and forth a lot, but I don't think she ever says, I knew when I handed it to appellant that these prescriptions were invalid. Under the second prong of the test, I don't think that there were sufficient corroborating circumstances to indicate the trustworthiness of those statements. Like we said earlier, she doesn't think that she's implicating herself, and I think that's really telling because courts have noted that indicates ignorance of the implications of any statements that she might be making against her penal interest, as opposed to actually being statements against her penal interest. In the way that that applies under the Strickland provision, I think it's important to note that under Strickland, the burden of proof is on appellant to demonstrate that trial counsel was ineffective. I think there just isn't enough based on the record to really indicate what the strategy was here. It could have been that Mr. Floyd determined that his conversation with Shauna Brooks would not have been admissible anyway. It could have been that he had done a lot of other preparation pre-trial, because he did conduct voir dire, he did conduct cross-examination of many witnesses, that he would have thought, in conjunction with Ms. Jimenez, the other counsel, that it would have been better for him to continue serving as counsel as opposed to potentially trying to be a witness whose statements may be inadmissible. The record does not clearly reflect what exactly was going on, and that just goes to prove that appellant has not carried his burden under the first or second prong under Strickland to demonstrate ineffective assistance. There were other points of error here. I think the state can rely on its brief, unless the court has any other questions regarding the other points of error that were raised in the brief, unless there are any other questions.
I probably am going to ask your opposing counsel a question about this: the police officer saying he didn't want to go to that area because it was high crime. So if you want to address that, go ahead, because you won't have another opportunity
sure,
to address
thank
that.
Sure, I think that if you look at the cross-examination of the arresting officer, I don't remember exactly how many times, but I know it's at least six times that defense counsel asks, now, why is it that you did not proceed to go to the hotel, the Royal Inn, and interview Ms. Brooks on the scene? The presumption being that your failure to do so is incompetence or failure to fully investigate this case. There was a motion in limine pretrial, which the court granted, saying that the court will not, the parties are not allowed to go into the fact that it was a drug area and that it was a high crime area. By asking that question repeatedly to the officer, why did you not go there? Why did you not go there? This is a straightforward application of defense counsel opening the door to previously inadmissible testimony, leaving the jury with the assumption that the officer, by failing to go to the scene of the crime, may have missed some crucial piece of evidence, leaves the jury with a misunderstanding of what the actual facts were. And so after both parties approached the bench, the judge limited the state in what they could go into, but said because counsel had opened the door to testimony about the nature of the Royal Inn, that the state, and the fact that the officer didn't go there, the state was allowed to ask the officer, well, why didn't you go there? And among his answers, the officer said, well, it's not protocol for me to go to the Royal Inn, to go to a high crime area with somebody in my custody. And he mentioned a couple other things. It wasn't the state, the officer in his answer and the state in the way that it was, the subject was broached, wasn't focusing on the fact that it was a high crime area. The state limited its answer to just making sure that the jury was not left with a misunderstanding with the implication that the officer did something wrong by not going, and that they understood that it was part of protocol for him not to do that, and that he didn't feel it necessary to do so. All of that was relevant, as well as the fact that it was a high crime area. All right, I guess I will go ahead and ask this court to affirm the lower decision of the trial court, and rely on the state's briefs for any remaining issues. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mrs. Sobolon. Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, just briefly. Just turning to that question about the high crime rate area, Your Honor, certainly while that is the state's contention on appeal, that wasn't the state's real reason at trial. If you look throughout the state's closing argument in the record, you'll see that what they were doing by presenting that evidence about it being a high crime rate was not to clarify or rebut any kind of defense position that the police work here was shoddy. What they were doing was insinuating that my client was guilty because she lives at a place where there's crimes that are committed around people who commit crimes.
But would you agree that by going into it to begin with, the door was open?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, that does open that door. But the way then it was used creates some kind of error there.
And were proper objections raised at the manner in which it was being used?
No, Your Honor. No objection was made to improper argument. but certainly that was the motive there, to insinuate that appellant was guilty because she chose to live in a hotel where people commit crimes. Now, turning to just briefly a couple of things that were brought up by the state. You know, the state on this argument of this is not against penal interest kind of wants to have its cake and eat it too, in the sense that they want to say right now on appeal that this was not a statement against Brooks's penal interest, and therefore it would have been inadmissible, and because of that, there is no harm. But at the same point in time during trial, the trial attorneys for the state did not want to grant immunity. Now, if it's not going to be harmful to her, if it's not going to be against her penal interest, why wouldn't you go ahead and grant immunity? But the state chose not to do that in this case, the trial court. And that's because everybody that was trying that case knew these were statements against her penal interest. They were going to be admissible. And to say now that potentially it was trial strategy on Ms. Jimenez and Mr. Floyd's part, that maybe they realized that statement was inadmissible, and so that's why he stayed as trial advocate, I don't believe that holds much water. Because if indeed that was his trial strategy, and he believed that this statement was going to be held inadmissible, then why would he ever try to call himself as a witness to testify about it? If prior to trial or during trial he had determined, you know what, this is going to be inadmissible.
Perhaps to invite error?
I don't think any attorney wants to invite being called ineffective. I would say that on any other kind of error.
Well, but you raised 2 points on appeal with regard to, you said that the trial court also erred by not allowing him to testify to begin with.
Yes, ma'am. I would argue that Rule 308, that prohibition, that is a code of professional conduct rule, but it does not trump the Constitution. And the Constitution says every person charged with a crime has the right to present their defense. And this went solely to the heart of her defense. And so I believe that in a situation like this, when we have a code of professional conduct rule conflicting with that 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment should trump that.
And if the trial counsel was aware of that, then that could have been trial strategy. We don't know.
That's correct, Your Honor. We don't know. It's not in the record. No. Unless there are other questions, before I sit down, the appellant would just pray that this honorable court sustain her objection to the conviction and order a new trial. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right. Now, your case is submitted. And thank you very much for your briefs, my arguments. Very good job. And we will adjourn now. And that's all for today with the court. Thank you very much.
You're excused. Can I ask her to pronounce her name again for
yes.
me?
Yes.
My first or my last?
Your last name.
Boulun. You change the B to a V and the O's to U's.
Boulun.
Yeah.
Thank you.